On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk Holly Hunter with broadcast news and Home for the Holidays.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills, there will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And thanks for downloading or listening to the Video Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this week, we decided to do two movies that had a really, really great and fantastic actress, Holly Hunter.
Yeah, because, you know, we talk about a lot of guy movies on this show. Have you ever noticed that, Ryan? There's a lot of testosterone and machismo in a lot of these things.
Oh, well, they're very bro-y.
And as I am a well-rounded film geek, I wanted to get away from that for at least 1 week before the season was over with. So I thought, you know, I love Holly Hunter. She's been in a ton of great movies, and no one really talks about how great she is, or at least I haven't heard anyone really talk about the greatness that is Holly Hunter in her career. She's been in a lot of great movies, and she's always top-notch.
She has. So I thought,
why not Holly Hunter?
Well, she has won, you know, she's a 7-time Primetime Emmy Award nominee. She's earned several Screen Actors Guild Awards, several, you know, Golden Globe Awards. And, you know, I don't think she did receive the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for The Firm and for 13. And then she also won the only Academy Award that she has won is for The Piano, which was in 1993. She was nominated for one of the movies that we're going to talk about in broadcast news, but she did not win.
I guess it is weird to call her underrated considering she's won an Oscar.
Yeah, but she's to me, I think, I mean, she's not like a Meryl Streep, you know what I mean? As far as like winning all these Oscars, but whatever character that she's in, she always, you know, nails it. I mean, I still can't believe I watch broadcast news and I'm like, this is the same, you know, person that was in, you know, Raising Arizona, you know, with a, you know, high strung, high energy, like just unbelievable. It's just, you know, you don't really get a sense even of, you know, if I met Holly Hunter, what she would be like, because her characters are so vastly different.
Yeah. But she's not. But she doesn't disappear into them. Like she's still. She has a unique. Her voice is very unique. She has a very unique Southern accent, and her energy changes from role to role. But she doesn't like melt into the role. So it's still her.
Mm-hmm.
So she's very unique in that way. Like she's got like she can play a lot. She has a lot of range.
Yes.
But she's not like a character actor. You know.
Yes. 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 She is from Georgia, so that gives her. That nice and cute Georgia accent. And
which we're going to talk about more when we get to Home for the Holidays, because that's really incongruous in Home for the Holidays.
Yeah, but it is. But but anyway, but one of the movies that that I know that I really identify with, because I grew up, my father was in radio, so I kind of grew up in this, you know, sort of communications industry. And to see this kind of movie about television production or about television news production that was done so seriously, so meticulously. And but it really, that isn't the focus. It's really the background to this sort of like love triangle that is between Holly Hunter's character, William Hurt's character, and Albert Brooks's character.
Mm-hmm. And it's all the television stuff seems very accurate to the time period. So it does this wonderful balancing act of showing you what it was like to run a broadcast news show in that time period, while also still being a very engaging character film.
Yeah, it wasn't tongue in cheek or made up, or it was completely believable, completely plausible, completely of that time period of what, you know, news production was in, you know, 1987, and that's when this movie was made. It was directed, produced, and written by James L. Brooks, who also...
He's legendary. Yeah. Let's get that out of the way. The legendary James L. Brooks.
James Legendary Brooks. I don't know what the L stands for.
Yeah.
But he's a writer for The Mary Tyler Moore Show, for Taxis. He's written episodes for The Simpsons. He also directed, I don't know if he wrote, Terms of Endearment, and also As Good as It Gets. So, I mean, the guy has done a lot of stuff between television and movies that were extremely popular and extremely successful.
Yeah, he's been a producer on The Simpsons for all 33 years of its existence. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's basically a TV super producer, and he's only made a few films. He's made about five, but they've all been at least critically successful.
Right.
He's got a hell of a track record.
Yes. So just to give a quick synopsis of broadcast news, Basket Case Network news reporter Jane Craig falls for reporter Tom Grunick, a pretty boy who represents the trend towards entertainment news she despises. Aaron Altman, a talented but plain correspondent, carries an unrequited.
I promise we went over this in the production meeting, folks.
I failed. Unrequited torch for Jane. Sparks fly between the three as the network prepares for big changes. Both the news and Jane must decide between style and substance. So, it really... I mean, this movie is like 2 hours long.
It's about 2 hours and 13 minutes.
Which was pretty long for 1987.
Well, you would think it seems like it's long for what seems like it's going to be a romantic comedy.
Right.
You know, which is kind of what it is.
Yeah. Because you have like an opening scene where she's given a speech, or not really, that's not really the opening scene, but the first thing that happened in the movie, she's given a speech about, you know, style versus substance, you know, in the news or whatever, and people are leaving and stuff like that, and she's trying to do what she can about it. But then after that, she goes back to the network, and there's this really hilarious, you know, thing where they're trying to get the tape to air, and, you know, they're running against the deadline, and poor Joan Cusack has to, like, run through the bowels of the television, you know, the network, you know, to get it on for the 6 o'clock news, you know?
Yeah. So basically what the story's kind of about, to kind of break down how it begins. It starts off by showing us our three main characters as children, establishing who they are as characters. You've got Holly Hunter, who's very kind of proper and detail-oriented and very serious, but also really assertive. You've got Albert Brooks' character, who's just kind of a smug know-it-all, but not in like an annoying way. Like he's likable, but he definitely knows how smart he is. And then you have William Hurt's character, who's obviously a very good-natured, sweet kid, but not that bright, but not like in an oafish way. Like, he tries really hard, he's just not naturally smart.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically it flashes forward, you know, so many years to where they're all basically working in this news station, and William Hurt's character is this new anchor that's being brought in, and he wants to learn from Holly Hunter and Albert Brooks' characters how to basically be an anchor at that level.
Yeah.
And then that's where the love triangle kind of starts. And you're right, there is a lot of kind of comedy and like really, really fun stuff in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
As you see kind of how the station works in organic ways. But you mentioned Joan Cusack, who apparently is in every 80s and 90s movie ever made.
Apparently.
Let's talk about the cast really quick. Yeah. I mean, like, William Hurt, like, he plays, like I said, the kind of the pretty boy love interest. an amazing actor.
Yeah.
Been in so many great things. Like, he was in a, let's see here, I've got my list here.
All right.
He was in The Big Chill.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
Yes.
He was in AI, Artificial Intelligence. Oh. A Dark City. He plays a recurring role in the Marvel Cinematic Universe as General Thunderbolt Ross for all of our comic book nerds out there who listen. And he was in one of my favorite Cronenberg movies. We've talked about Cronenberg on the show before. It's called A History of Violence. Mm. Phenomenal actor. He's got a real gravitas to him.
Yeah, he does. He really does.
And then you've got Albert Brooks, who is, you know, again, kind of like your plain Jane, kind of like, you know, he's kind of nerdy, but acerbic and smart and likable. He's a comedian and a writer. He was in Out of Sight, Taxi Driver. He wrote and directed a wonderful movie called Defending Your Life. And for our younger listeners, he's also Nemo's father in Finding Nemo.
Yeah. Yeah, Albert Brooks, he always plays like a, you know, kind of a dad type of character to me. He's always that kind of like not really well put together kind of, you know.
He's a little bit schlubby, like smart but schlubby.
Yeah.
Likeable, but you know, just kind of a schlub.
I think that sums it up well. I mean, but Holly Hunter, you know, playing this awesome sort of behind the scenes producer in a way, and it's weird. I mean, if you just had to sit there, if somebody like came up and said, "What's this movie about?" I would say it's like, well, it's about like the people involved with putting the news together, and there's this love triangle that's kind of like Pretty in Pink. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's almost that same thing where you have the girl and she has like the friend who she should probably be with, which is, you know, Albert Brooks's character, Aaron. And then she has like the pretty boy, which he kind of represents things that, you know, she doesn't like, but she's still like kind of smitten with him because he's just so, you know, so charming. And
handsome. Let's, yeah.
Right.
Some of it's superficial.
And he, you know, he has to come to, you know, Tom Grennick, you know, William Hurt's character has to come to Holly Hunter, you know, with some vulnerability, and that showing that vulnerability, I think what she really, you know, is sort of attracted to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
well, and you said something there that I want to speak to, which is a part of why I think Broadcast News is so great. It's the most realistic romantic comedy you'll ever see, because in my opinion, this is my interpretation, and maybe this is others. I've never read any critical work on it. But you said that she should probably be with Albert Brooks's character, and really, no, she shouldn't, because none of them should be with any of these three people. That's kind of the point of the movie at the end, that none of them should be together.
Yeah,
they're all nice people. They've all got flaws,
right?
And but just because you want to be with someone doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right fit,
right?
And
or just because you spend a lot of time together, or you're like really close friends, should you be romantically involved, I guess.
Yeah, and that's something that I think guys always go through as they're growing up. We have to kind of learn the difference of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very heartbreakingly real scene where Albert Brooks is kind of confessing how he feels to Holly Hunter's character, and he says, "I love you." And at that moment, she winces.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've ever had that happen to you. I've been in Albert Brooks' shoes in that before. I've told someone who I was friends with for a long time that I thought I loved them, and they winced.
Yeah.
So that's a very real and honest scene that really struck a chord with me.
Well, throughout all their conversations, you can definitely tell, and she just basically kind of ignores it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You can definitely tell he's like hinting at it, you know, very, very sort of hard, but she never really acts upon it at all. And it is sort of that, yeah, I've been in those situations too, and you know how those feel like. It's like, where you feel like you like somebody, but they're not reciprocating. But then, you know, you're really close friends, and you call each other, you know, and you talk a lot about each other, and you share a lot about, you know, things together. But then when it comes to being like romantically linked, like the feeling is not there. But yet Holly Hunter's character still cares about, you know, Aaron. She still, you know, cares about him. And, you know, as a close friend and as a close, you know, sort of coworker kind of thing.
Well, and I think that it's just something that guys often have trouble with. They have trouble separating platonic feelings from romantic feelings. I think that's a common thing that happens with men. And this movie's kind of about that. I mean, like, because again, Albert Brooks is a good guy. He's in the film. His character is smart, capable. But he really is kind of, he can be a little snide. He can be a little smug. And also, he's so into Holly Hunter's character that he also damages himself, because at one point, Joan Cusack's character actually says that she was kind of interested in him, but then he was too much of a jerk, so she lost interest.
Yeah.
And well, I mean, and you again, can, and it's very telling.
Yeah, you know? And you can tell the way that, you know, Aaron Altman, which is Albert Brooks' character, treated William Hurt's character. You know, it's just like, you know, here they're supposed to be colleagues or whatever, like working, it's not supposed to be a thing, but like, you know, he really, you know, treated him like he was a jerk, and
he really wasn't. Yeah, because no one was really a bad guy in this film. You should have people who are kind of all misguided.
Mm-hmm.
Like Holly Hunter's character is very obviously very lonely. Mm-hmm. And they keep having these scenes where she's crying by herself because she wants someone in her life, but she doesn't want to ruin this friendship with Albert Brooks' character.
Well,
but she doesn't.
Here's the thing about that. That's one way of looking at it, and I'm not discounting it whatsoever. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because the movie never really explains. There's like a few points in the movie where it starts off in the morning. It's like you see this routine where she unplugs the phone, and she has like she almost like makes herself cry. She gets like an ugly cry, and it's kind of like an ugly cry. And, you know, she just kind of sobs there for, you know, 20 seconds, 30 seconds. And then she just like kind of goes back. It's almost kind of like a release kind of thing. And it never is explained in the movie. I was hoping that at some point that some character would ask her about it, she would explain it. The character never really explains it. It's just left up to the audience to interpret like what's going on here. And, you know, I asked my wife about it, and I'm like, this is definitely a woman thing. This is definitely where, you know, there's a divide between men and women, and like, I don't understand, and the women, you know. And she said, well, probably, you know, she's in a man-dominated world, and she has to be tough, and that's her way, you know, because if you show your feelings or whatever, it's like showing weakness, and, you know, you just get eat up. So that's her way of like kind of dealing with it and kind of being tough and kind of like letting it all go at the beginning of the day, and then like she's good for the rest of the day. You know,
I think that's at least some of it. But I do think that loneliness plays a factor in it, because when she meets William Hurt's character, she very quickly kind of gloms on to him. You know, like I mean, because sure they have chemistry, but she very quickly, you know, flirts with him. She invites him back to her hotel room. She's obviously trying to come on to him. And it's all pretty quick.
Yeah.
It's because she has some emptiness in her life. Mm-hmm. All three of these characters have some emptiness in their life. They're all very successful. They're all doing very well. But they're all missing something. And they're trying to fill it with each other, which is really a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one scene of the in the hotel room when they first meet each other was rather interesting, because, you know, it almost seems like his character wanted to, you know, keep it like professional, and she's, you know, kind of trying to, you know, flirt with him in some strange, weird, nerdy way. And, you know, he's just not picking up on it, or just kind of ignoring it as best he can.
Well, she's also, she's also unintentionally condescending to him as well, because she's very smart, and, and she kind of thumbs her nose at him a little bit too. And he, you know.
Yeah. Because she's like, you're the person I represent. You're the reason why, you know, you're the style, like, and not the substance, you know, kind of news. Like, we don't need people like you. We need, you know, that sort of thing. And then, you know, she finds out that, like, he's the new, you know, reporter or whatever. So
yeah. and I'm sure as we're talking about this, it all sounds very heavy, mm-hmm. but it's actually a very funny movie. I mean, it is full of like witty banter and really genuinely funny moments. Like Albert yeah. Brooks in this is hilarious.
Oh yeah,
he's so sharp. He's so sharp witted, and he has so many great lines. Like at one point, he tries out to be the weekend anchor, and he fails miserably.
Mm-hmm.
But Holly Hunter's character doesn't see it, and she's like, "How did it go?" And he goes, "Well, did you see it?" And she goes, "No." And then he goes, "Well, it went great then." You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. And
it's a very light, kind of snappy film.
Yeah,
even though it is like I said, it's 2 hours and 13 minutes or so, which is again long for a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of pep to it. It's very snappy.
Yeah, it's very sort of amusing, you know what I mean? You know,
yes.
Like when those music guys show up to like you know, pitch the new sort of theme music for the news, you know what I mean? It's just kind of there's a little bit of absurdity there and stuff like that. So
well, it goes back yeah. to if you look at James L. Brooks's resume, again, it's lengthy and it's legendary when it comes to comedy. Mm-hmm. I mean, Taxi, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, The Simpsons. You can't get like more A-list than that, you know?
Yeah.
So he clearly knows what's funny.
Yeah. But I mean, but to me, it's almost like a real sort of kind of slice of life movie where it moves you through different stuff and the sort of, you know, symphony of scenes and things that take place. It's never really too serious or never really too, you know, like funny. It never really like breaks away at one way or the other. It's really because it's almost like watching, you know, like life like really happen, but not in a sad way or not in a fun way.
Yes.
It's just like you're just held on. It's almost like, well, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Who's she going to wind up with? How's this going to happen? And how's this going to work? And you know, you're just sitting there just like wanting, you know, these things to happen because you get just so wrapped up in the story, I think.
Well, the characters are so strong and it feels so honest and authentic. And that's the reason why James L. Brooks' stuff, at least in film, is very, to me, it's very amazing, is because it's funny and it's light. But yet it feels authentic and real. These feel like people. They don't feel like quip machines or like jokesters or just there. They don't feel like they're just there to be funny. They feel like living, breathing people who just happen to be clever and funny.
Yeah.
And that is such a hard thing to pull off.
Right.
He makes it look so easy.
And, oh, and we failed to mention showing up like randomly, not even listed anywhere on anything, is Jack Nicholson as like the main anchor of this, you know, national news or whatever.
Yeah. As an alumni from our last episode, the Joker himself showed up. You know, yeah. It's all interconnected, Ryan. It's all interconnected.
Yeah.
And
with his, you know, television sort of, you know, persona or, you know, charisma or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He's in a lot of James L. Brooks' stuff, but I mean, I had never seen Broadcast News before this, so it was a real delight to kind of throw it on and say, hey, there's Jack, because, you know, he elevates whatever he's in, so, and he's not in it a lot, but he's definitely memorable and enjoyable. It's like the big news anchor, like the big, like, celebrity news anchor of the station.
Yeah, I think I saw it a long time ago, like on TV. And I forgot that he was even on it. You know what I mean? I forgot that he was even there. Like, oh yeah, there he is.
The same thing with being surprised that Joan Cusack was in it. And also by the fact that Joan Cusack is in it, made me realize how dainty Holly Hunter is. Cause there's a moment where they hug.
Yeah.
And Joan Cusack, who I think is lovely and beautiful, looks like a giant.
I know.
Next to Holly Hunter.
I know, because Holly Hunter, I don't know, I have to look up like how tall she is or whatever, but it's like you see them like very rarely do they like kind of put them like side by side, especially from like the knee up or something like that, especially when you have
from
like
a distance,
short and tall people.
Yeah.
And they did for that because they're doing this like kind of full body hug because you know, cuz after the station, you know, this big sort of, you know, mass firing has happened and everybody's cleaning out their desks, you know, they give a hug and you're just like, oh my God, John Cusack is like a giant.
And I don't know if she's really that tall or if Holly Hunter's just that dainty. But man, it was an amazing visual to see because you don't really think about people in scale like that in film.
Yeah.
So, like you said, because so often they hide that stuff. We're so used to like the Tom Cruises of the world where they hide how short they are.
Yeah. You know. I think I'll look it up right quick while we're talking. But I think Holly Hunter is just like that petite, really.
Yeah. She looks just like said just the word dainty. Which is funny because she's such a firebrand in all the in every movie she's in, she's almost always so strong and fiery.
Yep.
But she is tiny.
Yes. Yeah. She is okay. So Holly Hunter is 5'2". Okay, which is about the same size as my wife. Okay, which that's
means
fine.
Nothing to our listeners, but that's interesting.
No, nobody thinks that's interesting at all. That'll give you a reference, though, because you
know, it does help me, so I appreciate that. Yeah.
And then we'll Joan Cusack and see how much she is. But yeah, Holly Hunter. I mean, you can just tell her voice in The Incredibles, you know, and The Incredibles too. Like she's, and I mean, like I said, even you know, the Coen brothers saw that when they cast her in. Raising Arizona. I mean, obviously, yeah, right?
Like she was one of their early friends. Like she's in their very first movie as like an uncredited voice.
Yeah,
like she's an old school friend of the Coen brothers. So she was there from the very beginning. There's a reason she keeps showing up in their work.
Yeah, like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
But Joan Cusack is 5'9".
Yeah, that's a huge difference. Yeah, 5'2" to 5'9" is that's yeah.
I think
that's a lot,
right? I think William Hurt's pretty tall too.
Yeah, he's a tall man.
Yeah, but I just think that it's still a great movie. What scenes would you want to savor and watch again, and which ones would you want to just you know fast forward through?
I don't think I'd want to cut anything out. I think it's a really great film. There's so little I have a problem with in it. I don't think I could take anything out of it. Now, as far as the scenes I savor the most, it's really just the scenes of banter between Holly Hunter and Albert Brooks. Like to me, those scenes are so like funny and snappy and just a joy to watch. Like they have so much charisma and chemistry. That really, anytime that they're just being friends and joking around with each other, it like warms my heart. Mm-hmm. So I love those scenes.
Yeah.
What about you?
I would fast forward through the ending because I really don't think that the epilogue kind of ending was even necessary. It didn't really do anything, you know, for me, and I would have just rather have it ended and everybody kind of go their separate ways. Like this is what we did when we're together. And then like everybody does their thing. And really Albert Brooks's character even has this kind of premonition, you know, about it where, and then after that, we kind of see it played out in the final epilogue. And I'm like, we didn't really need that.
That's a good point. It almost puts too fine a point on it, you know?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, looking back, I mean, probably the writers or James L. Brooks probably said, well, I can't just end it on a bad note. Like, I got to make people feel like good and warm and cozy or whatever. And I think that might have been fine for 87, but if he would have made that movie like in the 90s or the 2000s, like that would have been cut out.
It's entirely possible because like you don't need the final coda. You really don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because they end up exactly where the story implies they're going to end up.
Right.
It just wants to show you that they can still all kind of be friends years down the road. Like, they have that kind of high school reunion moment. Like, hey, it's 9 years later, and just look at how great I'm doing, or whatever. Right.
And there's no hard feelings about any of it, you know what I mean? So, I guess you're right, but I didn't really think that it was that necessary. Well,
no, you've actually sold me. I'm going to change my answer and steal yours. So, good job.
And then Saver... That scene between where Holly Hunter is the executive producer and like she's like feeding information to William Hurt as he's like on the air, and Albert Brooks is like calling in, like feeding information to Holly, and Holly's like feeding it to William's character. That was an amazing, amazing scene, and that was orchestrated and put together, and I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, I say it here, and he says it there.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yes, that was so awesome. So, that was great.
But yeah, but I like I said, I'd always wanted to see Broadcast News. You know, there's always going to be movies we have on our list of shame that we think, oh, I should get to that someday. And this was one of mine because I do like Albert Brooks. I love Holly Hunter. And I like James Earl Brooks' films. And I just never had a chance to see it or never got around to it. And I'm really glad we did. I ended up loving it. Comes with the highest possible recommendation for me.
Yeah, it's one of those laser discs I picked up because I'm like, oh yeah, this is a great movie, and I haven't watched it since I bought it, so it was a good excuse to watch it. And Holly Hunter is great in it. I think she should have won best actress for it, especially when you hear who did win for that year. But we'll get to that later. In the notes.
Okay. Well, that I don't know, so I'm curious to hear it.
So you'll hear who did win, because it did get nominated for a lot of Academy Awards. It really did.
As we move on to the next movie, to kind of preface the next movie, the real reason this episode really happened was we knew it was going to drop around Thanksgiving, and as you can attest to, Ryan, to pull back the curtain a little bit, I've been saying that if we're going to do an episode about Thanksgiving or near Thanksgiving, we have to do Home for the Holidays. I've been saying that almost since the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is always going to be people's and probably my like number one favorite like Thanksgiving movie. But it doesn't really capture, I mean, it captures like travel and holiday travel and that like sort of aspect of it. But to really capture like, you know, what it likes to be at home and deal with your awkward family and the people that you're related to, I think, you know, Home for the Holidays is the movie that you might like. You know what I mean?
It's almost the quintessential thing. It's really the quintessential Thanksgiving film,
right?
That was kind of the real genesis, the real kernel of the idea of how we ended up doing this episode. Well, I just really wanted to talk about Home for the Holidays around Thanksgiving because it's a movie that I watch with my parents every few years around Thanksgiving. My mom loves it, much like when we talked about The Replacements back when we did Keanu Reeves.
Oh wow!
Home for the Holidays is one of my mom's favorite movies.
Really?
So yeah. So wow. Weirdly enough, right? Considering you've seen it, but yeah. But she loves she loves The Replacements and she loves Home for the Holidays. Those are two of her favorite films.
Oh really? Wow. Yeah. I didn't know that at all. But no, Home for the Holidays. When I first watched it, just knowing, you know, you and kind of like your taste, I'm like, you know, Estrie's gonna love this movie, you know, and because it's just every character is just so just like weird, and as normal as they seem, they're just like so outlandish. It really reminded me of like a movie along the same lines as like something like Roseanne or, you know, Married with Children. This sort of idea of like not every household is like that household that we saw on TGIF. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It isn't exactly. It's not all like rosy and that sort of thing. Like there's a lot of, you know, a lot of just craziness in families. You know,
families are weird. Families bicker, but families love each other. And Home for the Holidays really nails that. But let's be more formal with it. What's Home for the Holidays about, Ryan?
All right. After losing her job, making out with her soon-to-be ex-boss, and finding out that her daughter plans to spend Thanksgiving with her boyfriend, Claudia Larson has to face spending the holiday with her family. She wonders if she can survive their crazy antics. So, yeah, I mean, that's how the movie starts. She, like, loses her job, and then, like, her daughter picks her up and says, oh, yeah, I'm gonna have sex with my boyfriend this weekend, you know, and then drops her off at the airport, and then like have fun with grandma and granddad, and so it's like okay, and then you know has to go through flying and then get home and then you know deal with graphic and just her appearance, and then yeah,
it's really just everything about Thanksgiving. Yeah, it's the in-laws, the awkwardness, having to sleep in your old room,
having to wake up early to like get the food ready and get the turkey ready, and
it's running into people you used to know in high school, and it's all weird and awkward. But one thing I love about Home for the Holidays is it's one of those movies where it doesn't hold your hand with information. You just kind of dropped into this person's life, and you kind of pick up things as you go along. You pick up through context who people are and like what's going on.
Well, you're,
and part of that is.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say part of that is due to the script by a guy named W.D. Richter.
Well,
who we've talked about on this show more than once.
Yeah, Walter Dutch Richter, who also he wrote the screenplay, who also wrote Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and was the producer and director of The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension that we mentioned on this show. And yeah,
he had a story credit on his as well. And he also wrote Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, he's a co-writer of Big Trouble in Little China. But yes, it is kind of like, you don't know where it's going. You're seeing everything through Holly Hunter's character's, Claudia's eyes. Like, we're just following her along in this, like, crazy sort of adventure. And it's almost like, you know, you get a little bit, like, things happen to her at first. And then the rest of it, she's just kind of, like, watching the antics happen at her home and her home family. It almost seems like the problems that she has are almost like normal, because she has this like gay sort of like, you know, really, you know, outlandish brother who's played by Robert Downey Jr. And then
it's Anne Bancroft's her mom It was at The Graduate. I mean, again, a legendary actress. She was Mrs. Robinson, of all people. Right. Yeah, and Charles Durning plays her father, and Charles Durning had a really great career, too. I mean, he was in, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? He was in the original Muppet movie.
Right.
He was in The Man with One Red Shoe. He was in The Sting with Paul Newman.
Yeah.
And also, he had a recurring role in Everybody Loves Raymond, and who doesn't like that TV show? I mean, that's classic television.
Right. And then Steve Guttenberg like plays her like brother-in-law.
We're never talking about Police Academy, so this is probably the only time I'm ever going to mention Steve Guttenberg.
Right.
But yeah, he's in it.
Yeah, and Cynthia Stevenson like plays her sister
from Dead Like Me. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just wild. Like everything that sort of transpires and. Oh, and then her aunt, like, what was her, is that,
Her aunt was played by Geraldine
Chaplin. Yeah, Geraldine Chaplin.
Geraldine Chaplin, yeah. who was in Altman's Nashville.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's great. She's really good in this, playing kind of the aunt, the older aunt with dementia.
Right.
Kind of the artistic old aunt, you know, who's a little bit of a free spirit, but she's clearly losing her mind.
Yeah.
And
then, like, professes that she made out with, you know, the patriarch of the family, like made out with him like long ago when first met or whatever when she
when they were 18 so
like everybody's just sitting at the table going okay alrighty then like
and so but a lot of the comedy and drama is sort of brought in by Robert Downey Jr.'s character as her brother. And I got to say, one thing I love about this movie is how progressive it is with this portrayal of gay and lesbian characters. Because Robert Downey Jr. plays a gay man in the film, but it's not a huge source of drama. I mean, there's a few moments where it's brought up for like tension, but his parents accept him and love him even though he's gay. And this was in 1995. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty big thing to show in media then, that the older generation would accept that their son was gay.
Well, part of the storyline was that he got married, but he was hiding it from the parents.
Yeah, you know? But they weren't mad. They weren't mad that he was gay. They were mad that he didn't tell them.
Yeah, because his husband, you know, called and, you know, the father answered the phone and, you know, he told him, well, you know, I guess I do mean this and congratulations are in order, you know, and it kind of meant like, you know, it's okay. I don't, you know, it's not, He's kind of like accepting of it, you know, and accepting of that. And so, yeah, it's just like a really sort of heartwarming moment to have happen in the middle of all that, you know.
And the movie's full of those kind of little things, but on top of all that, it doesn't shy away from the fact that family is really annoying.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
your family irritates you. Your family makes you mad. You argue with your family. You know,
like, but, how can I be related to these people? Like, this is not even the, like, this is, how did these three people, like, in the same household, like, wind up like the way that they are? And even their parents, like, how messed up are they? I mean, the father just seems to, like, I mean, it's no wonder he just, like, has this goofy smile and dances around the, you know, the house, because he's just like, F it. You know what I mean? Like, life is crazy and life is messy. He's just like, whatever. You know what I mean?
Because the movie, again, shows that you argue with your parents piss you off, your brothers and sisters piss you off, but in the same moment, you can be like, hey, I love you, and it's okay.
Yeah.
You can have those real kind of gentle moments, too, like, within the same, like, moment in time.
Yeah.
Because family's complicated. You don't have to like family, but you can't help but love them.
Right.
And the movie expresses that so well. And it does all that on top of also having a nice romantic subplot where Robert Downey Jr.'s character brings a friend home who everyone else assumes is gay, but is really there to meet Holly Hunter's character.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's heard her brother talk about him this entire time, and he wants to meet her, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's played by Dermot Mulroney.
No, Dylan McDermott.
I clearly wrote that down so I wouldn't do that. But you're right, Dylan McDermott from Steel Magnolias and The Practice.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm gonna say it again, Dylan McDermott, not Dermot Mulroney.
Yeah, no.
I literally wrote that down and said not. Yeah, you know how it
I'm
is.
I'm sure
folks.
That happens to both those guys more often. Yeah. But yes,
Dylan McDermott from the Practice, basically that long running TV show, and he is not to be weird, but he is devastatingly handsome in this movie.
I mean, just like William Hurt was kind of like the, you know, pretty boy, you know, he's, you know, Dylan McDermott is kind of the pretty boy in this movie. And he's definitely like, you know, sort of like the eye candy. And at first, like, because you're watching everything through Holly Hunter's eyes, you first think, oh, this is one of, you know, my brother's, like, boy toys that he's bringing over, and really realize that, like, no, he's not. He's, you know, he actually brought him. He's a coworker and
he's a coworker and a friend. Yeah,
exactly. And so, yeah, just so. But just a wild movie where just craziness ensues, and it all happens within like a couple of days, you know what I mean? It all starts like the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and then you kind of get, you know, Thanksgiving, and then
it's really only about 3 days.
Yeah.
And everything that happens in it is all very realistic stuff, but you know, again, it's all family drama, it's all family silliness. There's nothing like crazy happens, but it's like family crazy. Like, there's outbursts at like dinner, or you know, there's fighting and yelling, but there's nothing that's too outlandish, you know.
Yeah.
And it's another slice of life movie, and but it's all very kind of gentle comedy, and it's all kind of snappy, and
it's definitely a dark comedy. Let's just put it that way. I mean, a dark sort of family comedy, and this, in the same way, like I said, in the same vein of, like, you know, Married with Children or Roseanne, like, you know, like where families are messy, it's not, you know, it's not perfect, and crazy things happen, you know.
Well, it tries to show again a realistic portrayal of family. Like, it's not grim.
Yeah.
It's not a grim movie. It's not like a mean, and it's not mean. It's not a mean spirited film at all. It's just again, families irritate you sometimes, and you want to strangle them and then hug them in the same moment sometimes.
Yeah.
But a lot of the comedy is born out of Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, and he is great in this. I mean, we often forget that he was not always the mega movie star he is today, but he just gives a phenomenal performance as the younger brother. He's a bit of a free spirit. He's kind of a wild man.
He's so unpredictable, and it is funny to watch, like, young Tony Stark, you know, basically, because every time I see him now, I'm like, oh, there's Tony Stark. But no, it's Robert Downey Jr. to see him like this as this kind of like flamboyant sort of character that is just so wild and unpredictable. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like he's just very free and very fun. And it's a reminder that Robert Downey Jr., before he became the world's biggest movie star, was always a damn fine actor. And of course, Holly Hunter is, of course, if Holly Hunter wasn't great in it, the whole thing would fall apart. But she is like this wonderful like nucleus on which the whole thing rotates.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's like this little, she's got this little bit of, she's like the only sane person around in all this craziness. And it's just a delightful performance. Like, she knows enough to be a little silly and a little crazy to kind of feel like she comes from the family, but she never goes as broad as everyone else.
Yeah.
And when it comes time to play it serious or to have quiet moments with, like, Charles Durning as her father, they have these really warm, like, heartwarming moments with him and then with her mom. They feel very, very poignant and real. And she really handles both aspects of the film so very well. The only thing that bugs me about Home for the Holidays, and I never really thought about it until watching it this time, was that her entire family sounds like they're from Chicago, and she sounds like she's from Georgia. And they never once address it. Because Holly Hunter has never once hid her Southern accent. She's got a very unique Southern accent. And it felt really incongruous to me to hear it this time. I don't know why it bothered me this time. But it so clearly was not, like, her voice was nothing like the accents of the people around her.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because it starts off in Chicago. You're like, definitely in Chicago. And they never really mention the town that she's in. And I had this in the notes, but I'll go ahead and share it now, that it was filmed in Baltimore, but you kind of get the idea it could be, like, anywhere USA, like Akron, Ohio, you know, Philadelphia, or Pittsburgh, or Buffalo, New York, or, you know, somewhere, you know, on the Rust Belt, you know what I mean? Or somewhere it could have been... you know, somewhere else in Maryland. It could have been Richmond, Virginia. You know what I mean? It's just, it could have been a lot of different places, I think. So I think that's one of the reasons why they don't really say where they're from. But yeah, it's definitely not, you know, nobody's from the South or sounds like they're from the South except for Holly Hunter.
And if her accent wasn't so adorable, it would really if her accent wasn't so adorable, it would have killed me. But it's so adorable, and I love her so much.
The thing that got to me about the movie is that every sort of scene is set up like almost like a Saturday Night Live like sort of scene. You know what I mean? Like how crazy it is, but it's really. The thread between them all is, you know, not that it's thin, but it's just like you don't know really what you're building up to. You don't really know where you're headed. You don't really know where their characters are headed or, like, you know, sort of like the point other than, you know, just get through Thanksgiving. You know what I mean? And it's so even though you're watching, it's almost like watching – a car. I mean, I don't want to really say a car wreck, but you know what I mean. It's kind of a spectacle, but you don't really know where everything is really going to land. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you don't. And I think that the point of it is, I think the point of the film is kind of brought home in the last few scenes, where she's on the plane the guy meets her on the plane, and they decide to spend time together to figure out if their relationship's going to work. And then it cuts to all these other moments of the characters being happy with each other. Like, you see, like, her mom and dad being happy together. You see, like, her brother-in-law, Steve Guttenberg, and her sister, like, being happily married. And you see all these kind of characters. You see Robert Downey Jr. with his husband, and then they're being sweet together. And what the movie's about, to me, what it's trying to get you to feel is the idea that what matters in life is the relationships and the moments you have when you're not trying to have moments. And those are the moments that stick with you.
Yeah, but see, that's my point. I mean, I think it makes a great point, and I think that it definitely sort of lands it at the end, but you gotta get around everything else to sort of get there. So in the middle of it, it just seems like like chaos, you know what I mean? And there's a lot of quick dialogue that you have to keep up with, I think, especially from Robert Downey's Jr. character, you know what I mean? And everybody's like sort of, you know, where it's like a family where everybody's like sort of speaking at once and all that kind of stuff. But it's
sort of the, again, it goes back to the chaos. It's like, again, the slice of life, the chaos of family.
Yeah.
That honesty about how families are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, we skipped over a very big point about the movie. We didn't talk about who directed the movie, which is kind of a big deal.
Yeah. I totally forgot. It's directed by Jodie Foster.
Yeah, right.
Directed and produced by Jodie Foster. So she did it by her own production company.
Yeah, and the film looks great. I mean, it's a very nice film. It's got lots of nice framing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel too unrealistic. It's got a great visual style to it where it doesn't feel stagey. It feels very real.
Yeah, it's all shot on location. So for sure. So Jodie Foster, I mean, even though it was like the screenplay, and I got some notes about some of that as well, but what scenes would you like fast forward through and what scenes would you sort of savor?
I don't like the stuff at the very beginning where it shows Holly Hunter in her job and as an art restoration artist.
Uh-huh.
And how she gets fired and she makes out with her boss awkwardly, because you don't really need that stuff for the rest of the movie to work.
Mm.
And also the cutaways when they cut to Claire Danes at her other Thanksgiving, you see that her boyfriend's being a jerk and they're probably not going to sleep together.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff feels a little unnecessary to me too.
Mm.
So those scenes don't really move the plot along any.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really feel like they're necessary. I feel like you could do all that with dialogue.
Yeah. The actor who played Holly Hunter's character's boss is a guy named Austin Pendleton, who was also, he's also a Video Culture alum. He was in, he played like the court appointed lawyer in My Cousin Vinny. And he's also, Steve Guttenberg, who's also in Home for the Holidays. Both of them were in Short Circuit. But they don't share a scene together in Home for the Holidays.
Yeah, he's also in Finding Nemo, that Albert Brooks is in, and he's in the Muppet movie, which he's in the Muppet movie from 1979 with Charles Durning. Yeah. So
weird.
There's a lot of crossover there. Yeah.
Yeah, weird crossover with Finding Nemo with our other movie, honestly, with Broadcast News. Yeah.
And as far as the scenes that I would savor, I mean, I love so much about Home for the Holidays.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I love the scene where they're playing touch football and Charles Durning is washing the car and the boys get into the fight and he has to shoot him with the hose. Like, to me, that is my family.
Uh-huh.
It reminds me so much of like going to like my grandmother's house for like Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Wow.
And my cousins horsing around and taking it too seriously and having to get broken up with like being sprayed by a hose. It just, to me, that feels like such an honest moment of family, but it's so silly and fun at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that scene.
Yeah. Stuff I would fast forward through. I don't really need Anne Bancroft to like take her shirt off and, you know, for me to see her in a bra and a slip like that. I just don't need it.
I think
unnecessary. Like, I don't know.
No, I get what it's about, because it's supposed to comment on the idea of aging and how we think about ourselves as we age. Yeah. But I get where you're coming from.
You're just like, whoa, what's happening? What's going on? It's just out of nowhere. But that's the whole movie, really, right? Like, out of nowhere, like crazy things are happening.
Well, you know, you don't see anything. It's just like, she's just kind of like, she's talking to Holly Hunter as her daughter, and then she's getting ready for bed. And, you know, kind of the casualness you have around your family when it comes to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But as somebody who's never seen the film before, I can see it being like, why is she undressing right now? That's weird. But
And then moments I would savor, just because, I mean, the little bit of opposite of you, not because of any particular reason, just because I love Claire Danes and had a crush on her when I was younger, so I just want more Claire Danes in the movie. Just can't.
She is adorable. Yeah, that's Claire Danes of my so-called lifetime period.
It is.
So
yeah.
She, super adorable.
Yeah,
but I had a huge crush on Holly Hunter when I was younger. Yeah, so,
for our audiences in 1995, I was when this movie came out, I was probably like barely 18 years old. So. I mean, Claire Danes is only, you know, she was probably like 17, I think, when she did this movie or something like that. So
yeah.
She's only like 1 year younger than me. So people don't chide me. Okay. I know she was young, but I was young back then too. Okay.
We grew up with her. It's okay.
I fell in love with her when she was in, you know, my so-called life because I was about the same age. So there you go. But yeah, cause I, and she, I mean, she plays an awesome character. I love, I mean, her character.
She's
was good great.
In everything she's oh, in. Yeah. yeah she,
playing. So it fantastic. So, but yeah, I, in the scene too, where the, like the turkey.
Oh, yeah.
The turkey carving. Scene.
Just carving the turkey.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it gets all over the sister and, you know, she leaves and splits and, you know, they all, you know, can I get mad at each other for, you know,
they have that little bit of third act conflict. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so, but anything else we want to add before we get to any of the notes for Home for the Holidays?
Before we get to the notes, let's just go and ask, I mean, you never seen these movies. I mean, I never seen Broadcast News before, but you had never seen either of these. So what did you think of them? Did you like them? Did you not like them?
I mean, I really liked both of them. I thought Broadcast News was definitely a little bit like harder to watch because it's not a fuzzy, warm story. And Broadcast News was really sort of long, and I didn't really quite like the ending, although the ending is more what real life would be like. But like both of them, I think, are very sort of, you know, realistic to real life. They're both like very sort of slice of life movies. And that's what I told you when we had our pre-production. I said, it's so odd how these movies are so sort of like very similar. You know what I mean? Because even at the end of Home for the Holidays, it's like, she, you know, sort of like realizes that there's a connection between her and the Dylan McDermott character, but they live in different cities and it's going to be hard to make it work the same way as like, you know, Holly Hunter's character and, you know, William Hurt's character. I mean, they come from different places and how you're going to really make that work when they have like not only like living in different places, but just sort of different philosophies about things. So I just thought that it was... It was very sort of similar in that sort of vein that they're both very real, and I think that it just shows a little bit about what Holly Hunter would choose as a script and characters that she wants to play. I mean, even if you can see it in like the, you know, the one where she won an Academy Award, like the piano, you know, it's very sort of these deep and real female characters, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're always meaty roles. She's never one dimensional.
No,
which is one that I always appreciate that about her. And she's looking for honesty in the parts she takes. And as a film fan, as a person who appreciates film, I like that. I like that she's looking for honesty because to me, I know I've said this before, but films are empathy machines. They are things meant to manufacture empathy.
Mm-hmm.
They're meant to make you feel.
Yeah.
And these movies definitely will make you feel a gamut of emotions. I think they're both great.
Yeah.
I'd highly recommend them.
And I think you could probably take, you know, Home for the Holidays and turn it into like a three-act, like, off-Broadway play.
Yes.
You know, it would play so great, I think, to the stage. That would be really, really awesome. You know,
it really has this, been done.
Yeah, it really has kind of a... Death of a Salesman type of feel to it. You know what I mean? So,
well, let's get to that trivia, brother.
All right. So, Broadcast News. Holly Hunter's character of Jane Craig was based on journalist and news producer Susan Zirinsky. She served as associate producer and technical advisor for the film. Susan Zirinsky was the executive producer of 48 Hours, not the movie, but the CBS investigative reporting show 48 Hours. from 1996 to 2019, and she is now the president of CBS News. So she has been around a while. She has been at CBS News since 1972, where she helped write stories about the Watergate scandal to covering the White House, and also worked with Dan Rather in Kuwait during the Gulf War. So part of her story is really like wielded into Holly Hunter's character, Jane Craig, and so much so that Zirinsky even gave Holly Hunter some of her clothes to wear in the film.
Huh.
Yes.
Neat.
Yeah. So if you look up Susan Zirinsky, you can learn a lot more about her. She's a very fascinating woman, and she's I think one of the first female she was one of the first female executive producers, and now she's the first female president of, you know, a major news organization. So amazing. Although originally written for Holly Hunter, it was originally, the character of Jane Craig was originally written for Deborah Winger, but Deborah Winger became pregnant, so that's when Holly Hunter came in. Deborah Winger and James L. Brooks worked together previously on Terms of Endearment, and James L. Brooks considered Sigourney Weaver, Judy Davis, Elizabeth McGovern, Christine Lottie, and Elizabeth Perkins. Which I don't think any of them would have been the same movie with any of those.
No, you really need the kind of energy that Holly Hunter brings to a movie. You really do.
Yeah,
she's got this fiery quality to her. She's like a spark plug, you know.
Mm-hmm. Jack Nicholson was not paid for his role at his own request, and his name only appears in credits and on one of the artwork or promotional materials. So it never appears on any of the artwork or promotional materials. That's what I mean. He only appears in the credits. So he must have been real good friends with James L. Brooks or something.
Yeah, they've worked together a lot. Yeah.
Okay. There is a cameo of John Cusack. Did you know that?
I did not. I didn't see him.
He is in the credits. It's credited as Angry Messenger during one of the staff firings. A young man yells, "Sons of bitches!" and angry throws a messenger bag into the office floor. The character's face isn't seen, but the voice is John Cusack's.
Huh.
Yep. Mark Shaman and Glenn Roven, who played news theme writers, are actual real-life composers who have also done television jingles. Shaman, after doing this movie, went on to score major motion picture films and has since been nominated for 7 Academy Awards.
Well, the song they play in the film is actually pretty good. So
yeah, you're like,
that makes sense.
It's almost kind of an unnecessary scene that they're in, you know what I mean? But I think that it gives a little more depth to, you know, the absurdity of, like I said, of the television station. Because they really have to do that, right? They really have to come up with those things. But yeah, it almost got like real sort of Ron Burgundy-ish, you know?
Just a moment.
Just like real quick second. The score for the movie was actually done by Bill Conti, who wrote the theme to Rocky.
Does it get more iconic than the theme to Rocky?
Yeah. Broadcast News was nominated for 7 Academy Awards and won none of them.
Which is a shame.
So let's go through the list right quick, okay?
Okay.
Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor by Albert Brooks, Best Original Screenplay, Best Cinematography, and Best Film Editing. So, Holly Hunter, we'll first start with that because we're talking about Holly Hunter. She lost to Cher in Moonstruck.
Well, and let's be fair, Moonstruck is really great.
It is, but I think that she only lost because, you know, Cher's been in movies before, but that film and that character, I mean, I think just surprised a lot of audiences. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, everybody can give, you know, that was in, we covered Mermaids and stuff before. And people were like, okay, we've seen this stuff before. But, and, you know, she was also in Mask. But then she was in, you know, Moonstruck, and it was like, oh, okay. You know what I mean? It was, You know, and it's such more of a happy sort of a movie. But I think that's if I really sit down and look at it and look at the talents of the actors and actresses, I would give it to Holly Hunter.
Well, here's the way I look at it. To be a film nerd and say it in a film snobbish way, both these movies are in the Criterion Collection.
Yeah.
So they're both quality films. I mean, Broadcast News is in the Criterion Collection, and Moonstruck is being added very, very soon. So they're considered both important films, and they're both obviously high quality. And I'd have to go back and rewatch Moonstruck. I'm going to watch it soon because I haven't seen it in forever.
Yeah.
But,
maybe we should put it on our list somewhere.
We're gonna do more Nicolas Cage episodes, so we can do romantic comedy Nicolas Cage.
There you go. Maybe do one and what was the Las Vegas one where his
it was Honeymoon in Vegas. Honeymoon in Vegas. There you go.
That's it. All right.
There you go. That's going on the list.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Next season. So
if the world doesn't end,
yeah, this is how we come up with episodes, guys. Like seriously.
Yeah.
All right. So to your point. Broadcast News also lost to Moonstruck in the category for best original screenplay. So,
see, yeah, I'd have to compare them closer, but because they're both great movies, I don't know which one I would choose, honestly.
Okay,
I need to go back and watch Moonstruck again because it is really good, but I've not seen it in probably 10 years.
Yeah,
while Broadcast News is very, very fresh in my mind.
Yeah. Well, and yeah. All right. Well, moving on. So it lost, Broadcast News lost Best Director and Best Motion Picture to The Last Emperor. So, and I think, I mean, really, if you think about it, I mean, this is 1987, right? You know, The Last Emperor is this very, like, I don't know, high cinema film. And I think that's where, like, sort of
it's a prestige picture. Yeah,
exactly.
As say.
Because you know you got stuff like you know City Slickers and whatever, and they're like, this film, yeah. You know. So to me, I think it's just a nod to that high cinema. Really, be quite honest.
Well, and I'm gonna go say this right now: the Oscars don't really mean anything.
No.
They really don't.
I mean,
time and time again. Five years away from it, you really can see that they mean nothing. We really should be doing the best movies of the year 5 years after that year happened.
I agree.
You know, 'cause we need some perspective to understand what's important and what's actually good and what's not.
I agree. And I only talk about it on the show just because it's interesting to talk about, you know, just from the perspective of...
podcast.
Yeah, it's like what happened in the past, you know, that sort of thing. Moving on. Best Supporting Actor... for Albert Brooks, lost to Sean Connery in The Untouchables.
Now, that's some bullshit. Because I love Sean Connery, but he is Sean Connery in everything.
Well, I think that's one of once again, it's like the Academy just wanted to give him an award because he's up for an award. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Best Actor, lost to Michael Douglas in Wall Street. So, but for William Hurt lost to Michael Douglas in Wall Street.
Yeah, that one I can understand because Wall Street, if anything, Michael Douglas is really great in Wall Street. I can say that because we saw Wall Street recently during the season.
Yeah.
It's a really good performance. I may not be the hugest fan of the movie in general, but that's a great performance.
And that really altered Michael Douglas's career. That was really like a departure, you know, sort of character. So I can see that. Okay, so. It was nominated for 5 Golden Globes, but also no winners. I'm not going to go through all of those. Roger Ebert, though, gave Broadcast News 4 stars out of 4.
His highest score.
Yep. He praised the film for being as, quote, knowledgeable about the TV news gathering process as any movie ever made. But it also has insights into the more personal matter of how people use high-pressure jobs as a way to avoiding time alone with themselves. And that's where I kind of depart from Roger Ebert. I mean, I know people who work in radio and worked in television and stuff like that, and I don't think they really they don't really use these high-pressure jobs as a way to avoid. It's just that they love radio or they love TV news and that's what they want to do. So they pay like sort of any sort of personal price to be there. If it means that they have to pick up and go live in Portland, Oregon, because there's a TV station that needs an anchor, then they're going to go do it, and they're going to relocate and replant themselves into that city. And if they get fired, then they'll move to Austin, Texas, if that's what it means, because they love being a part of that, you know, that process, I think. And yeah. I think that's callings. And Ebert should get that. I mean, he worked at a newspaper. So,
he's a newspaper man, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't really know. So, like I said, I don't necessarily agree with that assessment.
I think it's true of the characters in the film.
Well,
I don't know if that's
they do avoid time alone with themselves, but I mean, it's just like you're around the same people all the time when you're in these high pressure situations, you know, like a political campaign or you know, stuff like this. Like you work together a lot, like all the time, you know. So
it's true.
They become your friends. They become your confidants. They, you know, those are the people that you see every day. They become part of your family. You know, you know them better than you know your own family. And, you know, eventually you care for them like your family. And eventually sometimes you want to be with them and all the time. So I don't know. Rotten.
I get what you're saying. Got just a bit rambly there. Sorry. But I got what you're saying.
I'll get off my high horse, okay? I'll step down. Rotten Tomatoes. This is the highest, I think, score of a film that we've watched. 98% critic score.
That's really high.
79% audience score. It is not. Yeah, go ahead.
Because it's not a traditional happy ending.
No.
You can always tell if they're going to be lower with the audience because when they're not a traditional happy ending.
Other 98%, it is not on the top 100 movies of all time from Rotten Tomatoes. But other 98% films that are on that list are movies like The Wizard of Oz, Get Out, Moonlight, Inside Out, The Farewell, The Godfather, The Godfather Part 2, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, E.T., King Kong, Alien, Zootopia, A Hard Day's Night, The Bride of Frankenstein, Jaws, Toy Story, Lawrence of Arabia. So, that's some great company to be in at 98% critic score. So, in 2018... Broadcast News was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress for being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. And yes, you are correct. It is part of the Criterion Collection, spine number 552. So, speaking of the ending, James L. Brooks did shoot a scene that was shot after principal photography that William Hurt and Holly are in the taxi at the airport. It was completely unscripted, though it was never used. He basically kind of just gave them some direction, and he told William Hurt, like, whatever you do, you can't get on that airplane. And then he was just going to, like, watch what happened. And the two actors were actually really great with that ending, but he wound up not using it at all. So it's probably one of those situations that he either watched, I don't know if test audiences or I don't know what happened. And I don't even know if it's on any of the DVDs or uncut or alternate endings or something like that. It might be.
Yeah, I've got the disc. I've honestly never watched the disc. I need to break it out and see.
We'll see if we get that information for you guys later. So moving on for Home for the Holidays. It was adapted, even though that it was written by W.D. Richter, it was adapted from a short story by a guy named Chris Radent that appeared in the Boston Phoenix, which the Boston Phoenix is an alternative weekly periodical. So what some people would call like the zine or something like that, right? Like we have one here in Nashville called like the Nashville Scene. So that's basically what it was in. It is not the directorial debut of Jodie Foster. She actually directed Little Man Tate the year before in 1994.
She's had a pretty good directorial career, honestly.
Foster said, quote, "The great challenge was to find a beautiful idea to pull through a narrative line that would make the story work." So she kind of saw what I saw, like bunch of just like crazy stories happening, and you kind of needed a narrative to kind of work through. So screenwriter W.D. Richter worked on the script to reflect Foster's point of view and incorporated a little bit of her own life's experiences in that to come up with the final screenplay. And when Holly Hunter read the script, she agreed to it pretty much immediately. So that tells you a lot. Robert Downey Jr. publicly admitted to using heroin during the making of this film. Jodie Foster.
Yeah.
Hold on.
I was gonna bring that up. This is definitely during his drug phase.
Oh, for sure. You can definitely tell. Jodie Foster wrote him a letter praising his work, but warning him that he could not keep doing this on other films. Which I guess he didn't really take her advice.
No, it was a lot of years before he got his act together.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Anne Bancroft and Claire Danes play a grandmother and granddaughter on how to make an American quilt that also came out that same year in 1995, although neither film do they share any screen time together.
And that'll be the last time we mention how to make an American quilt on the show.
Don't say never. I know we probably won't watch it, but it might come up in some trivia sometime. I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. I may have jinxed us.
Okay. I know you're sidestepping that film as big as you can, right? It was, like I said, it was mentioned before, shot in Baltimore. Foster picked Baltimore because it was, quote, the prototype of the American city. It's dangerous, east coastly, and urban, yet has still a hopeful quality to it. So the budget was $20 million. The box office made $22.1 million. And I didn't get Roger Ebert. My notes fall off here. So I know the Rotten Tomatoes is only 63% critics and 72% audience.
And why is the audience higher? Because it has a more traditional happy ending.
Is that what you think?
That's my theory when it comes to audience scores with Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay. Like that, if it's a happy ending, then it's going to have a little bit like higher, not higher than the critics, but just a little bit higher overall, I guess.
It'll be a higher score relative to the critics' score.
I see. So Roger Ebert praised, he gave it 3.5 stars. So 3.5. And he praised Foster's ability to direct and Downey's performance that brings out all the complexities of a character who has used a quick wit to keep the world's hurt at arm's length. So it was New York Times that praised Janet Maslin, displaying a dizziness more mild manner than cool, crisp intelligence shows in Copycat. Mrs. Hunter still holds it together, home for the holidays with a sympathetic performance. Sympathetic performance.
Sympathetic.
Yeah. Sorry.
It's all right, man. It's all right.
My brain is failing me at the end of the day.
Yeah.
My eyes are getting crossed.
Yeah, we always record these fairly late, so
yeah.
Man, it's not your fault.
At the end of a long working day. So what sort of suggestions do you have for these films?
Well, before we get into that, as far as if you were to rent these from the video store, would you keep an extra day or would you return it early? I obviously would keep them. I think they're great. What about you, Ryan?
I mean, I have Broadcast News. You know, I don't know if I would keep Home for the Holidays. I mean, as much as I love it, I'm still surprised that your mom like watches it like every year, and it's just sort of a thing.
I don't know why. It's odd, right?
Yeah, it's like kind of like watching a train wreck, you know, happen. You know what I mean?
But again, I think it's because it's got a hopeful quality, and the humor in it is based in a realness, and I think that's what she responds to.
I see.
But as far as recommendations, I do have a couple. I mean, or I do have one. I'm not gonna go for like the obvious ones or some of the things we mentioned. The movie I'm gonna recommend is another Holly Hunter film called A Life Less Ordinary, and it's directed in by a guy named Danny Boyle, who did Trainspotting and Slumdog Millionaire. It also stars Ewan McGregor And it's basically like a zany comedy with Cameron Diaz in it as well. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of these people who fall in love and they go on this adventure that's been fated by the angels. Mm-hmm. Literally, it's been fated by angels. And one of the angels is played by Holly Hunter. And it's a very hard to describe film. It was not successful when it came out, but I've always thought it was really good. Mm-hmm. And one of those movies that I'll always defend to people whenever it gets brought up as saying it's a bad Danny Boyle movie. Mm-hmm. I think it's really good. Holly Hunter's great in it. And it's so unique. And we're talking about Holly Hunter today. I have to stand for this movie. And again, it's called A Life Less Ordinary.
All right. My suggestions are, watching broadcast news and also seeing like Joan Cusack just reminded me a lot and seeing like the success of like Holly Hunter's character and like this man sort of dominated world. I just got reminded of flashbacks of Working Girl. And I think that would kind of go together well with broadcast news. The odd thing is I actually did a Google search. I was like, movies like broadcast news. Number one suggestion, Working Girl. So even Google agrees with me and sees kind of eye to eye because I kind of get some ideas about what I think. And then like, you know, then it sort of happens. It's kind of weird.
Well, the movie I'd mentioned to give one other one. Another movie that we covered is FM.
Yeah.
You know, but it's about a radio station. So I think that would go really well with it as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then watching Home for the Holidays, it really just struck me as this movie called Dan in Real Life, starring Steve Carell, where I don't think it's really like a holiday, but it's kind of like a family sort of gathering kind of thing. And it's where, like, you know, you're having to deal with your odd family, but, you know, Dan kind of plays, or Steve Carell, and Dan's character is just really, like, unsure of himself. His wife died, you know, many years ago, and he's never really, like, you know, found another girl or whatever. And so he finally finds one, but then she kind of falls in love or is kind of smitten by... was it his brother or something like that, I think?
Yes.
Yeah, so kind of one of those weird sort of love triangle, sort of awkward family things. I really like that movie. I remember, watching it in the theater and really enjoying that film.
I think the vibe of it would work very, very well with Home for the Holidays. So I think that's a good call.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the action takes place in like that one... sort of like vacation house they have or whatever. And it's all very family oriented. And it's not quite as like dysfunctional, I think, as, you know, Home for the Holidays, but it's also not quite as deep and rosy as like, you know, TGIF Families or something like that. It's still very, sure, still very real, I think.
Yeah. I would agree with that for sure. So I think that kind of brings us towards the end of everything, my friend. So let's talk a little bit about next week because, you know, this is our 2 weeks from now, I should say. Mm-hmm. This is our last double feature for the season.
Yeah.
We are at an end.
We're getting near the end of season two, and, you know, we'll kind of like have, it'll be fun to look back on our, you know, retrospective as for season two. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yep, in 2 weeks, we're going to be looking back at everything we talked about over season two, like which movies were our favorites, which ones stuck with us, which ones we wish we hadn't watched, like The Golden Child, yeah. Maybe. And we're going to just kind of reflect on the year that's been, and that's in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It's going to be a regiment.
Right. And it's been an odd, you know, sort of 2020. So very interesting to go back from the beginning and look through. So
to look at it through the prism of how we look through everything here. Yeah. And that's with the movies. And, with that thought, I'm Matthew Estrin.
I'm Ryan Akery.
Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
Ready, BTR 1 and 2. Ready on camera 1 with key.
3.
All right, and announcement. Get ready.
1.
And cue them. And go.
All remote standby, please.
This okay, we're going to George. Say, the F-14 is one of the most difficult planes to master.
Executive producer.
One of the most difficult machines for a pilot to master.
I'll tell you something else. You know, I'm getting less and less airtime. They don't think I'm at all anchor material.
I can't believe I just risked my life for a network that tests my face with focus groups.
Is there any particular area that you feel strongest in?
To be honest, I was best at anchor.
So, you have almost no experience, and you can't write.
What I don't know, I can learn. What I do know, nobody can teach.
I'll buy you a drink. There's a big thing going on over at the Italian embassy.
I'm not sure I'd be good company tonight.
I am beginning to repel people I'm trying to seduce.
Wouldn't this be a great world if insecurity and desperation made us more attractive? If needy were a turn-on?
Incredible! Who's here?
Who?
Me. Let me just be your most trusted friend now, the one that gets to say all the awful stuff, okay?
I guess.
You can't end up with Tom, because it totally goes against everything that you're about.
I was half hoping I wouldn't have a good time tonight. You know why?
Because you're nuts.
He'll be nice and helpful, and he'll get all the great women.
What do you do when your real life exceeds your dreams?
Keep it to yourself.
I can't breathe. Over a guy.
I would give anything if you were two people. So I could call up the one who's my friend and tell her about the one that I like so much.